Hey everyone, welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark LaLiberty, and joining me today is...
Corey Cyborg Knockreiner.
Today's episode, we have a very special treat with you, for you. We have an interview with a
with
very...
With you and for you.
Yes, exactly. Words are hard. An interview with a very prominent biohacker. Without spoiling the fun, let's go ahead and jump right in. So today we have a very special guest today. We're going to have an interview with a prominent biohacker, Emil Grofstra. Emil, you want to say hi?
Hey, how's it going?
Awesome. It is going well. Let's go ahead and start with, you want to give us a bit of a background on yourself?
Sure. Yeah. My name is Emil Grofstra. I'm the CEO and founder of Dangerous Things and more recently VivoKey Technologies. I kind of started getting into this kind of biohacking stuff a little bit before it was called biohacking, I think. I implanted my first transponder to my left hand in March 2005, quickly followed by a second in my right. And ever since then, I've kind of been tinkering in this area, but around 2013, when the maker revolution really started to get underway, I turned it into a business model. I was either that or ignore all the emails I was getting. So ever since then, I've been building this up as an industry.
Cool. And by the way, a twist on that question, that was kind of your background, but we like to ask, what's your hacker origin story? Was it biohacking that you started with, or was there any other security topics you were into before you actually got into the biohacking?
Well, I think mostly it's just a curiosity about technology, really. As a young kid, the typical take things apart and then try to figure out how to put them back together. And then there's like, oh, there's five extra screws. that kind of thing. And just getting into, for the old schoolers out there, getting into phone freaking and, hacking into, phone exchanges, PBXs, things like that. And, always just very interested in technology and in particular, in communications. Like I remember I got a 1200 baud modem for Christmas, and this was shortly after War Games came out. And it was fascinating to me that, my computer could be talking to another computer. And of course it was super slow. So I would maybe I want to download a file, right? So I start the download and then I walk outside because it's going to be a while. And I'm walking around looking at the phone lines that connect my house with everything else. And I'm like, wow, the data, the bits is flying over this copper wire. And then I realized wait, that copper wire is literally physically connected all the way through for miles and miles and miles to the other computer. There's things that are moving electrons around and that's all connected. And that's just crazy. The whole idea that this, and back then even, the technologies were rudimentary, but there was still this vast network of connections. And I was just amazed by that. So I've always been intrigued by technologies and how to use them in new, fascinating ways.
Awesome. It sounds like we have similar origin stories. I remember when text files took a while to download and you could literally type faster than some of the terminals would spit out text.
I'm a bit later. I remember.
Did you ever visit the ANTOTSI?
No, I did not visit the ANTOTSI, but I definitely have heard of it.
Had some files downloaded from there, maybe.
Plead the fifth, Corey.
Yeah. Well, what are you talking about? I do remember getting my first frack magazines from BBSs and definitely some blueprints. You mentioned freaking. I made a black box, a urine box, and eventually a rainbow box, and it was all based on plans you would get from BBSs. So we grew up around the same time.
Cool. That's awesome.
So you mentioned 2005 was your first RFID implant. Why, I guess is the question. What was your, what's the driver for that?
It was just out of laziness and being irritated. So I worked at this medical clinic in the basement, and I was running this kind of managed software environment for medical facilities. So it basically, if you know anything about medical, most medical clinics have a practice management system. And this is like a Linux-based system that sits in a server that is managed by a third party. So it's in the facility and it's managed by a third party, but it's, all the computers in the facility are either dumb terminals or they're Windows boxes running terminal software. And that's, the whole practice management system is nothing but terminal-based. And so when HIPAA law came around, that left a big problem because then all the machines, the client machines needed to be managed as well to comply. And so we basically rolled out managed environments using Windows Terminal Server. So it's a terminal accessing another terminal. But the point is that everything was managed. And so we would plunk our box down next to the practice management box, and that was the thing. So I was working out of this basement office in a clinic, and, you know, IT, late nights, 2 a.m., and I would constantly lock myself out of my office. And the security guy was getting rather irritated having to come let me back in. You know, and I'd have to sit outside, sometimes in the rain. This is Seattle area, so it's rainy more than it's not. And it was just terrible. It was bad. So I'm like, I got to do something to make this door recognize that it's me and let me in. And so I looked at like fingerprint reading or iris scanning, and they were clunky technologies. They were expensive, and they really didn't work well outdoors. And they're kind of not any better now. You know, access badges, the cards you pop up at the door, those were like cheap, robust, worked well outside. I wanted that. And I realized that it wouldn't really solve my problem, because trading a metal key for a plastic card isn't any different. I would probably still leave it inside, right? So I thought, well, you know, dogs and cats have been getting these things for decades by the billions, and they're safe, and that's RFID technology. So maybe I can look into it. I found a company that made animal tags, and I said, hey, do you have something that's not an animal tag, not the same chip, but something more common, like an EM4102 or something? And they said, oh, yeah, we have something that's compatible. So I got some samples from them, and then I built this access control system. And by the time the samples arrived, I'd already talked to my doctor, and I said, hey, man, let's put this in my hand. And he's like, oh, interesting. You know, kind of was like, what is it? And I said, it's like the chips that pets get, but it's not a pet chip. It's like a different thing. And he was kind of into technology, so it worked out well. And he's, you know, 5 minutes of conversation, he's like, yeah, let's do it. So put it in the hand and started using it immediately, and was very happy. So it kind of took
That's
off
pretty awesome.
From there. Once,
so pure practicality, right?
Yeah, it's practicality, exactly. So, you know, I was using it from day one to get in the building. And, you know, almost from that point on, I had gotten rid of my keys, because quickly I was like, I need to do this for my car. I need to get rid of like all of my normal keys now and just replace with this. And that was fairly easy to do, being kind of the hackery electronics type. So I was just doing that and happily living my life until a friend of mine saw what I was doing. He's like, what did you just do? How did you open that door? And he's like, no way. Took some pictures and I think maybe, no, not a video. It was pretty early. It was 2005. So he took some pictures, I think, with a camera, like not a phone.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, yeah. And so, you know, then somehow he contacted a blog. I think it was like Boing Boing or something. Maybe it was
awesome.
Boing Boing.
Yeah.
It got
sense.
On somewhere, and it just went crazy. And Slashdot picked it up, and like BME Body Mod Magazine picked it up. And Body Mod Magazine actually did the first real actual interview about it. And the guy was awesome. He was like, this is amazing. This is going to change, you know, Body Mod. It's going to change everything. And I was like, I just want to get rid of my keys. but it kind of took off from there.
So to back up, just because we have a kind of nerdy audience, we've been throwing out some terms like we've used RFID, and I think we'll be talking about NFC. For the people listening, RFID stands for radio frequency identification. But just out of curiosity, like if you were to talk about RFID, what makes it useful for this type of purpose?
Yeah, so RFID is a big umbrella term. And the first use of RFID really was in World War II. The British modified a radar system to be able to ping planes, and the plane would have a special reflector in it, and it would reflect a specific kind of signal. So they were able to say, oh, these are our friendly planes. Don't shoot them down. Oh, no reflector, get them. And so from there,
essentially friend or foe indicators, right?
Yeah, exactly. IFF, very early IFF. And so from there it evolved. And RFID in general, as you said, means radio frequency identification. So any radio signal or anything that has some unique identification method, whether that's your MAC address on Wi-Fi. I mean, your phone alone has 5-6 radios, each of them with a specific physical address. So it's a massive RFID broadcaster. But what I'm working with here are passive RFID transponders. And they're fundamentally different in that they don't emit EM waves into space. They work without any power source and without any battery by literally you place them inside of a magnetic field that's created by like a loop coil in a reader. And so that magnetic field, you know, it's a couple inches, right? It creates this bubble. And then you place the tag in that bubble, it pulls power from the field and then actually modulates the field. Even after getting power, it doesn't broadcast anything. It just modulates that field a little bit, shakes it around a bit. The reader can feel those shakes and then goes, oh, okay, that's a one, that's a zero. So it's a really cool way to put something that's an identifier, so a tiny little computer into something that doesn't require power maintenance. And that's perfect for an implant. You don't need to charge it. You don't need to do anything with it. It just goes in. And that's why pets have been getting them forever.
Awesome. And let's see if my memory is good for your site. I mean, as you mentioned, there's a couple different standards now for RFID that have become pretty big. And I assume there's different radio bands, but I think you're using the 13.56 megahertz, kind of the smart card standard. I heard you throw out a standard while you were mentioning your origin. What was the standard you use most?
Yeah, so there's standards, and then there's kind of de facto standards that aren't really standards. So in the passive family of RFID transponders, there's two major frequency groups. There's low frequency, which is 125 kilohertz to 134 kilohertz. And then there's high frequency, which is 13.56 megahertz. And when you say radio bands, that is true. But again, these are not emitters. They don't actually transmit on those bands. The way this works is kind of similar to a transformer. So a transformer has a primary coil and a secondary coil. And the primary coil in this scenario is the reader. So the reader antenna is a coil of wire, and it's resonating at a specific frequency, and then you bring the tag in, and that's the secondary. So it pulls some power from that. So at best, it's like an air core transformer. So yeah, they operate in these two kind of families, I guess, frequency families. And the low frequency, there's some standards, like animal ID standards for pets and things. Of course, we in the US don't really follow that standard. And so we have all kinds of other things going on. But in that low frequency family, there's things like access cards, things like that, and there's de facto standards. So EM is a company called EM Marin Microelectronic. They have just a de facto standard of EM 4100, 4200 family. It's a specific kind of memory structure and method of transmitting an ID on the low frequency family, and it's just so prevalent that it's kind of become a de facto standard. So that's the kind of chip that I have in my left hand. It's EM4102.
Cool. By the way, since we're talking,
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, since you're talking about the fact that while there are some standards, it seems to be kind of Wild West. I mean, as long as you stay in the frequency range, how you actually organize data it sounds like could be different. If you're like someone that's just trying to reverse somebody's car, do things like smart radios help, or is there special equipment that you can use to just passively figuring out what some random third party RFID is spitting out and try to figure out its standard, assuming it doesn't use one you already know?
Yeah, so essentially in the low frequency band in particular, there's a ton of different encoding schemes and methods of command sets, things like that. HID procs, EM4102, Ndala, AWID, and there's a bunch of different ones. But they all essentially do talk on that 125 kilohertz frequency. So you can use, there's one particular utility tool that works really well for both families, and that's called the Proxmark 3. It's a device that was designed open source a long time ago and released. And it was very expensive at the time, but now being open source and China being, you know, in the game of nabbing open source and releasing, there are some really cheap options out there. But essentially, it is a diagnostic and investigation tool. So it deals with both families. You hook it up, you get the firmware loaded, you have a little command line interface, and you can literally just stick a card onto the antenna and say, like, search, like low frequency LF search. And it will look at the tag and go, we think this tag is this. And it will tell you and spit out the ID and kind of really help you along in figuring out what a particular card is. And in fact, we have a product called the XEM, there's two products, the XEM or the Next, which is a combination of two different chips in one implant, but they use, on the low frequency family, they use a T5577 chip, which is a really interesting chip because you can configure the analog front end for this chip, meaning you can tell it, I want you to act like an HID prox, or I want you to act like an EM chip, or I want you to act like an AWID, and here's the ID that I want you to spit out. So it will emulate these other kind of de facto standard chip types in the low frequency band. So you can, oftentimes you can copy or clone like a work badge into an implant and not have to talk to anybody at the company. And usually it's better you don't do that because they're shocked off and they're like, oh my God, what are you doing? They don't really, they kind of view this technology most of the time as just a plastic version or digital version of a key and keyring set, but they don't really understand that that's not how it should work and why it's important to have security. But even so,
is that like, the case for all of them? Is it essentially security by obscurity? They're assuming you don't have the equipment to read it. Like we've all seen, you know, other people have done hotel key cards. I think they've even shown it on Mr. Robot. Are there some that have started to built in some sort of, I guess it's hard with low power.
It's not hard at all. It used to be hard, but now it's not hard at all to have security. In fact, our one of the VivoKey implants is actually a full secure element. So it'll run Java card applets. You can code yourself and push them into this device, and it will run software that you wrote yourself. So with crypto algorithms and everything. So it's not an issue of power. It's really an issue of cost. There's two issues, actually, in access control. There's cost, and then there's kind of trapping your customer, right? So if you do offer, you know, a system that says, well, you can buy this system for thousands of dollars, and then we'll sell you these cards, right? And the cards could either be, you know, $2 or $30. And the difference in chip price is not that extreme, but the difference is on the secure ones, yes, they are secure, and it avoids all this problem, but the company will often use those security features to lock you in, to say, basically, yes, you could buy another card that has the exact same chip and use that card with the system, but we're going to block that, and we're going to use the security features of that chip to ensure that only the cards that we initialize with our special stuff will be able to be used with our, you know, system. So it's kind of a shady business, this whole security thing. And I think it's really time to explore some disruption, which is kind of on my roadmap, to be honest.
So it sounds like technology has changed quite a bit since even when you just got started with this this whole area.
Yeah, I mean, in 2005, there were secure chips, but because of the, really, it was just the transistor manufacturing and everything, and they weren't really sure how to efficiently do things like encryption. And so there were a lot of proprietary algorithms, like MyFair Classic uses Crypto1, which is MyFair Classic is a 1356 card type that has been distributed by the millions. It still is, but it's totally cracked. Like, it's easy to crack and copy. And that's, you know, any kind of hotel key card thing you see happening like that, that's a MyFair Classic card that was used, and it's easy to crack with the Proxmark and other tools. So, but at the time, there were secure chips that did do stuff like RSA, open standards security, but it took like 5 to 10 seconds to complete that transaction. So nobody was going to use that, right? Yeah. But now chips are smaller, more power efficient. They can work better with the small amount of power they do get, and they can, you know, have crypto processors that are geared just for this kind of thing. And so it's much faster, you know, almost no difference in usability.
Have you upgraded the chip in your hand with any of this new stuff yet?
Well, I mean, right now I have six devices. The original chip that's in my left is still there. It's the EM4102, and I really don't want to take it out just for nostalgia purposes. It is the first one, and so, but the right hand has had many in and out of it, prototypes, products, and right now I believe I have our XNT in my right hand, an XEM in my right hand. A left hand has a FlexNT, which is a biopolymer version of the XNT. It's a much, it's a super thin 0.4 millimeter thick device that has much better coupling power with these kind of flat plane reader antenna geometries. And then I have the VivoKey Flex1 prototype that has been in there for 3 years. And that one has actual Java card applets on it. So right now I'm using it for PGP, OTP, so two-factor key generation, which is really cool, actually. And it's kind of the point of this, which is if I put all this stuff into my phone and then there's a problem, either a security problem with my phone, or I lose it, or it gets stolen or whatever, then I'm kind of screwed, right? And so this way, I literally carry everything that's essential with me at all times. And I can literally say, hey, can I borrow your phone, generate my key codes, log in, and then hand you your phone back, and there's zero risk to me, because it's just, I'm just borrowing your phone as an interface. But all that stuff, the important stuff, is done in Vivo.
So you kind of preluded to this, but you started just kind of wanting to unlock doors, but there's a lot these things can do. You mentioned passwords, multi-factor, probably stores for keys, especially if you're doing Bitcoin too, things like that. One thing I'm curious about with the technology is, what's the data store like? Is that one of the things changing? I mean, in the past, the basic RFID readers weren't really storing much data. But nowadays, if you want passwords and OTP and stuff, you're trying to put more on the cards, obviously, or the implants. How is that changing?
So there's we're kind of going to step over a line now into NFC, and the proliferation of NFC support, near field communication, in mobile phones in particular, has really kind of spawned these new interesting applications. And so, you know, NFC is a specific subset of RFID. So every NFC tag is also an RFID tag, but not every RFID tag is NFC compliant. So what that means is, essentially, as smartphones began to have these new interfaces, new radios, NFC capabilities, we started looking at chips that could store data. And that data is stored in what's called an NDEF record format. So that's an NFC compatible way of encapsulating your data that you store in the chip. So an example would be a URL. You tap a phone to an NFC tag, it launches the browser, it points it at the URL. Or it could be a vCard with your contact details that goes right into the address book, which is a really cool application. So, you know, these chips started to be used as these data stores. But again, that's not a security application, it's just a data store. And so if you stored, for example, your Bitcoin keys on your implant, that's probably not a good idea. It's not a good idea because somebody could read it and you use it to empty your wallet. Or if you encrypt it with an application level encryption system, it's still not that useful because, again, it's not really doing any work. It's just storing some data for you. And the work is done on a general computing device like your phone, which could be compromised, could be somebody else's phone, there could be issues. So where the VivoKey product really went in the Flex One, you know, we said, well, what if we could actually take the Bitcoin transaction details in Vivo and then do the signature in Vivo so that the private key for the wallet never actually leaves the chip, never gets broadcast anywhere, and you actually do the cryptography work in Vivo. So, you know, when it comes to, you know, OTP key generation or PGP or Bitcoin, that the important thing is that that work is being done in the chip and in a way that doesn't transmit that key anywhere else. So that's a major difference from just storing some data. And that's the important part about, like, the thing that we want to see proliferate and we want to kind of build a structure around is the idea of bring your own identity, in the same way that bring your own device kind of changed and revolutionized the enterprise in the early, you know, 2000s. So the idea that rather than having all these identity tokens issued to you, and we have this kind of keychain mindset where we keep adding these tokens to a keychain or cards in a wallet or something like that, what really matters is identity that is standards-based, and it's something like public key. So if I say, well, I want to be able to get through these doors, here's my public key. Only I have the private key. And that should be good enough because it's standards-based, it's actually secure. And the work of doing that, you know, that signing process to be able to access network resources or physical access is done in an implant you can't lose. Some people say, you know, why bother with an implant? I can just use a USB token or some kind of token. And the reality is cryptography has been around for a very long time, but the reason it's not proliferated is that because it works. Cryptography is powerful. It does work, and you can't get around it. That's the issue. So you have to somehow be able to manage the inevitable loss of these tokens. And that's, you know, either you dumb down or cripple the security of the system so there's backdoors or some way around this problem, or you just have to accept the fact that the person has now lost access to it. So you see this all the time with Bitcoin wallets where the wallet key is lost and it's tough luck. There's no way around it. So again, being an implant fundamentally changes the management burden that a person experiences. I mean, if you look at Fitbits, like 50% of them end up in the drawer. If you look at patient compliance, you know, people that need to wear like a heart monitor, it's terrible. It's like 36%, and this is life or death, and they're still not doing it. So, you know, when it comes to something like this, you want to be able to interact with your digital identity and your digital assets in the same way that you interact with a door. You just want to reach out and grab the knob, and that's what an implant enables. It makes things practical.
That's very cool.
To be secure.
What do you think about, by the way, I really like your identity idea. One of the things, I'm digressing a bit, but because of things like the Equifax hack, unfortunately, even though it's not a secure, it was never intended as a secure validation method. Social security numbers have kind of become the United States standard for national IDs. And of course, all countries seem to have, a few of them started doing certificates and stuff, but most have numbers, unencrypted numbers. And as we're seeing, they're being stolen all over. And if that is our strong authenticator for identity, it's obviously way too weak. So in one of the podcasts, me and Mark talked about, well, I guess the solution would be chipping babies or having a certificate, which sounds, on one hand, you know,
well,
the
when
paranoid,
you put it that way,
yeah, it gets a little freaky to some people because it's newfangled. But in reality, it's a much stronger token of authentication. Do you have any thoughts of a national standard of identification that literally becomes our standard of validation?
Yeah, I mean, the idea of a baby needing strong encryption to validate their identity is probably a bit too far. Like, you don't even need to get a social security number until you're 16 or so, you know? So I don't think we need to start chipping babies. But, you know, the idea is that we do need some sort of identifier that works in a much stronger way. And the problem with any of these approaches that we've seen, static data, whether it's usernames, passwords, social security numbers, or even biometric data, that is static data. It's analog data that's digitized in a static way. It's all terrible, right? As you know, like healthcare, they don't even bother with any of that. They just get your name and your birthday, which, you know, aside from the issue of, you know, having multiple records and other people with the same names and birthdays. I mean, my mom works in the medical billing industry for you know, medical clinic. And so she sees it all the time. There's sometimes patients with the same name and same birthday, or it's off by a year, or, and then you end up with multiple records, things being billed wrong. So it's all just terrible. And the idea of kind of a secure identity token, I think, is a good one. You know, if you look at like Estonia, they have the e-residency card system. It's a smart card. It has a crypto program on the card that, you know, you basically sign in with your weak, you know, username and password, but you don't get to do anything until you actually use the card. It suffers from the same issue, people losing their cards. They lose their card, they need to go to a government ID center and like prove their identity again and get a new card and everything. But, you know, whatever standard we come up with should use the same kind of public key cryptography to be able to validate our identities online and in person. What form factor that takes, I think, is up to the person, like if they want to have a wearable or a ring or, you know, a card in their wallet, whatever, that's fine. As long as the standard allows for standards-based crypto, and then people that want to use an implant can choose to do so.
Cool. Good point.
So going on to some of your other hobbies, a few years ago, you actually made quite a bit of news when you made a smart gun. You want to tell us a little bit about like what brought you to doing that and anything you learned from it?
Sure. So I kind of talked a little bit earlier about this, which is, you know, our RFID in an implant form is about practicality, and it makes certain things practical. In my opinion, a smart gun that does not work with an implant is not practical. If you look at every kind of argument from the pro gun, like, lobby, I get whatever the groups of people that are like, go guns. They're like, you know, they list, well, I don't want the gun to need to have this thing that I have to wear all the time to be able to fire. Like, I need to be able to get the gun and shoot it immediately to protect my family, kind of thing. That's a very big argument against smart guns. And the thing about it is,
point, by the way, to jump out of implants, a fingerprint reader would slow them down too, right? Because you already mentioned if it was wet or unfortunately the time to identify with a fingerprint reader may not be perfect.
Yeah, so when you're dealing with any kind of digitizing technology where the system needs to take in analog data and then interpret it, right? That's going to be you know, a scanner, a fingerprint scanner, for example. So there's got to be a margin of error that is allowed. Otherwise, because you're never going to present a perfect fingerprint every time. So you need to kind of widen this margin of error. And if you want it to work faster and more reliably, then you need a huge margin of error. So basically, anybody who picks up the gun will get a green light to fire it. You know, or, you know, you've seen this issue. Even Apple phones, you know, you try to get the fingerprint reader. It's not perfect. It's not great. So, you know, when you're talking about a smart gun application, really the issue is if you have to wear a wristband or a ring or have a token and a necklace around your neck or something like that, that's not practical. And it's not practical because wearables are fashion items, right? They're extra management that you burden yourself with having to manage all the time. And as we know, you know, even Adam Sandler said it best, like phone, wallet, and keys, that's really the limit of what we can manage. Beyond that is too much, right? And so, you know, when you're dealing with this extra thing that you now have to wear 24/7 for the rest of your life for an event that might not ever happen, that hopefully you hope never happens, right? It's just not practical. So people end up putting that same ring in the gun safe with the gun, or under the pillow with the gun, or whatever. It wouldn't work. And so an implant, being completely managementless, frictionless, it's just there. It does its job. You don't even think about it. It's kind of like your kidneys. They're working hard for you, but you don't give them a second thought. And that's how a well-designed implantable device like this works. So you have it in there. You need to use the gun. You pick it up. It reads upon picking up and unlocks the trigger. In fact, I think I timed it. It was like probably the fastest. It's about as long as it takes to unlock a safety on a gun as it takes to read. So, I mean, it's fast. That's the whole point. It's fast, and you don't have to manage it. You don't have to think about it. And there's other people that argue, you know, well, I don't want added complexity to my gun, right? I need it to be a simple machine, and that will make it, you know, less likely to have a problem. And that's true, but that doesn't mean there's no market for a smart gun. In fact, if you talk about like the complexity, and you could either have a dumb gun with no smart gun capabilities inside of a gun safe, because you need some way, if you're a family person with kids or whatever, you need some way to secure it, right? So that same, you know, safety device, that safe, you see electronics gun safes all the time. That's the same exact concept, just moved out of the safe into the gun. So there's no real risk profile difference between the two. So again, put it in the gun and then don't bother with the safe. Just have the gun in the drawer, right? Like, you can do that now safely because the gun is intelligent enough to not just fire willy-nilly. So, I mean, there's kind of a practicality argument that just proliferates this whole entire thing, and it doesn't make sense without an implant.
And by the way, just we'll probably talk about your site dangerous things soon, but since you brought up safes, it may not have been designed for gun safe, but I think we all got a kick out of, you have this very cool air vent safe. It looks like a standard air vent, but it actually, if you have an implant, if you swipe your hand over it, I presume it opens into a safe. So pretty cool. If you don't have the smart gun upgrade, at least you can still use your implant to open that neatly hidden safe.
It's true. Yeah. It's a cool thing. We don't make it. It's made by a company, QuickSafe, but yeah, they have like shelving that has the same thing. It drops down, or this thing that looks like a air return vent. And yeah, you just tap your hand on it. Boom. It opens up, and inside there you can have the normal one, or there's like a deep one that with extra depth in the inside the wall that you can, I don't know, probably put a pretty big ass gun in there. it's basically a hidden safe that you can access with an implant or a card or whatever. But the point being, like, you never forget your card if it's implanted.
Yeah, you made that point very clear. You know, occasionally I was wondering what the point of implants were, but I think the immediacy of not having to think about what you're carrying, that is truly an awesome benefit. We've all forgotten our keys.
Yeah, and it's the forgetting of the keys, but it's also that management burden on a daily basis. That's what I really don't miss, right? I would probably forget my keys or lose them, you know, in a critical scenario, maybe once every 2-3 months, right? Where I'm like, damn, I'm late or whatever. That's great to not ever have to worry about that. And I haven't worried about it for nearly 15 years now. But the actual real interesting thing is every other day of my life where I'm not lugging around this giant keychain of, you know, cut metal pieces that represent me to some system or systems, and, you know, having it clunk around in my pants and sitting on them, and like, just every time I get up, I'm like, do I have all my stuff? Like, that is really the secret. That's the main benefit. I mean, the kind of equate it to, you know, when you were a kid and you'd run out the front door with no keys, no wallet, no worries at all. You just run out in your freedom. Like, there's a sense of freedom there. Yeah, I mean, try that now as an adult. It's not going to go down so well, right? So being able to use these systems with something that is now literally and, you know, philosophically and psychologically part of who you are as your human capabilities now, it's not a tool you pick up and manage. It's part of who you are as a person now. So there is a sense of freedom and kind of still, I mean, even today, like 15 years later, it's still a bit magical when I use, you know, my implant to open stuff. It's very mundane, of course, but it's still, there's a sense of magic and freedom there where I'm just like, boop, and I'm not doing anything radically different. I'm just reaching for the door. I swipe by the little sensor and I open it, and it's like, great.
So last question I have, and I'll let Mark take over a bit too, but I think we've talked about a lot of things you can do. Obviously, opening keys. We talked about how you can actually do encrypted. You can have a private key stored on the device and do the cryptography there. Some of the things we haven't mentioned, but it's all the same concept, is payment systems. I mean, we are using Apple Pay and Google Pay. Then there's some more modern, you know, states and countries have like chips for transit systems, stuff like that. So you know all the things you can do. But my question to you is, I presume some of these are all different standards. And, you know, you mentioned you have 6 implants now. How close are we to the, and maybe it is with the new card where you can run Java apps and you can maybe have multiple ones. How close do you think we are to the business side of things actually having enough common standards that for any password or any transit system and or any whatever, you'll be able to use one implant and have your single identity?
Yeah, it's getting there. And the thing about it isn't necessarily the standards. So the VivoKey Flex 1 can totally talk to payment terminals. That's not the issue. The issue 99% of the time, well, I would just say 100% of the time, the issue is not the technology. The issue is people. It's people and policy getting in the way of integration. That's really what it comes down to. So for years and years and years, you know, I've had some version of the VivoKey Flex 1 in prototype or whatever, and it's always had the ability to use the ISO 14443 standard to talk to a payment terminal. But what it doesn't have is approval from MasterCard, Visa, EMV, so Europay, MasterCard, Visa. They're kind of the consortium that holds the purse strings in a kind of a stranglehold on this global payments network that is, you know, based on MasterCard and Visa. So if you want to do anything with that, you have to get their approval. And then you can go to a bank and say, hey, let's do this thing. But so it's not up to the banks. It's not up to anybody but those, you know, few players on these processing networks. So that's always been the issue. And they've been very, very skittish about this. I mean, we've even had banks that are like, yeah, let's do it, gung ho. But we can't get any response back from you know, the players that control those strings, right? So yeah, again, not a technology issue. It's mostly the things that people want to happen or don't want to happen for whatever reason. That's the issue. So in the access control scenario, companies don't want to make systems that can use any old card. They could, technology's there, but they want to make sure that the customer always buys cards from them. Or, you know, they don't want you know, their customer using the competitor's card, access cards with their system. I mean, there's just reasons, right? So again, technology could do amazing things, but people get in the way.
So what's your 100-year view on this? Do you think like 100 years from now, we will have a chip implanted in us when we get our first job or our first credit card or
even younger?
It's hard to say. I mean, maybe, but possibly. And the only reason is that there's going to be something implanted, whether or not it's something like this or something completely different. Yes, I think so. And the reason is this. I mean, even today, I just now like watched this video of Kim Kardashian saying she loves data manipulation and screwing people online for money. Like, it's a deep fake, but it is perfect. It's a perfect deep fake, right? And this is the issue. Like, biometric systems or systems that rely on your identity as, you know, Our ability as human beings to validate identity is going to fly out the window. Like, I'm looking at a video of you guys right now. If I met you in person, I go, oh yeah, it's you. But I have no idea if it's really you, right? I really don't know. I mean, even online, when we're just typing to each other, you really have no idea who you're talking to for real. But you're like, well, I can solve that. I'll call the person on the video chat and then we'll have a chat. No, that will not solve it. And that's today, right? That's not 100 years. That's today. I really couldn't tell you if you two looking in the camera right now are really who you are. Like, I have no
idea. We're actually Cylons, by the way. Right?
Yes, Cylons.
Yeah. So that's the issue, right? So the idea of identity is radically changing now, right now. And VivoKey being a cryptographic proof is part of how we are going to fight against this, I think. So posting something, for example, on social media where you sign it with a signature, a cryptographic signature. Say, this is really me. I'm really posting this. That can become standard, right?
By the way, this is pretty... Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
You know, that's the issue. If you move this forward 100 years, you know, I personally think that the holy grail here is the brain-computer interface, right? Like, and the only way to really get there is going to be the development of a synthetic synapse, not neural lace, not, you know, these kind of barbaric, you know, electrodes that jam themselves into neural tissue and like listen to, you know, shock the neurons and then listen to their screams. Like, that's just not going to work in long term. But if you consider material science advances, you know, in 100 years, that's a lot of advancement. So if we actually get to the point where we can create a synthetic synapse that can trap and release and communicate with, you know, neural transmitters, talk to synapses in their native language, really become part of an integrated neural expansion, then, you know, we attach those things to like Amazon Brain Cloud, where we like spin up a bunch of neurons so we can think about hard problems or whatever. Like, in that scenario, we still have the analog issue, right? We still have the identity problem. It's not encrypted in any way. So, you know, if you could somehow mimic the brain patterns of another person at that point to literally be them online, I mean, it just, it, you don't want to think about it too hard. Terrifying. So, you know, like,
we need to call up Elon Musk and tell him to be careful with Neuralink. Has he think? I love Neuralink, but
he wants to be able to get us on par with AI, which is going to have its own rapid expansion, right? So, I totally understand the drive to do this, but it's going. You know, people have asked me in the previous 15 years, like, what does this mean about humanity? And I'm like, it doesn't mean anything. As long as we keep our curiosity, I mean, we've always been transhumanists. We're always striving to be better, faster, stronger, harder, right? Like, that's us. That's what we do. So as long as we keep that drive, that's, you know, and our curiosity, I think we'll always be human. But when you start talking about this kind of radical integration with neural networks, where, you know, you can start communicating concepts, even the idea of words goes out the window. Why would you need to take a meat, you know, hinge and start flapping it up and down to make sounds to communicate concepts when you don't even need to do that anymore? Like, even the idea of language itself is moot. So, you know, how would you think then? Right now we think in words, but if you don't need to use words, would we lose that inner voice? Would we now communicate in emotions or other things? I mean, you could just go on and on.
It's kind of weird, by the way, if you think about it. I kind of make, you and I are older, so I don't know. I have a daughter. I kind of make fun of the new smartphone culture where my daughter does not communicate in person as much. And while this isn't what you're talking about, where we literally have brain-to-brain communication, if you think about it, the way younger generations are communicating digitally on the phone is kind of the first sign of this change of speaking and words to emojis or whatever.
I mean, I've had entire conversations that are equally emotional in depth using nothing but memes. This is true. And again, what Elon Musk says, it's really, we're already here. It's just an issue of bandwidth. Concept communication through thumbs and tapping is low bandwidth. Once we have high bandwidth, we're just going to radically change the species.
Yeah, tell us a bit about what you're working on, Dangerous Things, and anything else you want to promote.
So yeah, Dangerous Things was the biohacking company I started in 2013, and you know, a lot of people wonder why Dangerous Things, why the name. And it really fit for the time. I mean, people that were interested in this were very, you know, literally cutting edge, bleeding edge people. You know, I figured those people are not going to be dissuaded by the word. It could have been called Safe Things and it wouldn't have mattered, right? So, but what I found very interesting was that rapidly the type of customer changed from, you know, a highly technical customer who's like, you know, tell me what scalpel to get and what does the data sheet say and give me some frequency and some sample code, to customers that were like, how do I use this at work? You know, so the type of, you know, customer changed to a mass market type customer very, very quickly, really. And so that prompted a few things. That prompted, let's solve a real problem here. And that's VivoKey is centered around that. But also, you know, let's create a name and a brand that's not, you know, biohacker. It's more like, you know, I mean, if you think about the word hack, right, it's a very negative connotation, but
it didn't really start that way, but it's become that way.
It's kind of becoming like a revered thing, but it's still very punk, right? It's cyberpunk. Yeah. It's, you know, it's kind of gutter, you know, something in the shadows. And so the reality is, though, that hack really just means an unconventional approach. And if it's an efficient approach and a good approach, it's no longer a hack. It becomes normal. And so, you know, that's kind of, we're in transition right now for this idea. We're moving out of a chip implant being a biohack into a chip implant being an option, right? And so yep. VivoKey wants to explore those options in a way that's supporting customers that might not be technical. You know, they just want to get in their car and drive. They don't want to know how the powertrain works, right? So that's the kind of thing that we want to do with VivoKey.
Cool.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Emil, for joining us. This was fantastic.
Yep.
And we hope to have you on again sometime in the future,
too. Yeah, we'll do a part two.
Thanks again for listening, everyone. And thank you, Emil, for joining us. As always, if you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. If you have any questions about today's topic or suggestions for future episode topics, feel free to reach out to us on Twitter. I'm at @XORRO_. Corey is at @SecAdept, and the both of us are at #the443podcast. Thanks again, and we will see you next week.
Where's the off button on this thing?
It's inside you.